Welcome to the library and to what promises to be a terrific opening for the fall season's Conversations from the Kullman Center. I'm Jean Strauss, the director of the Kullman Center for Scholars and Writers, which is up on the second floor here. And I apologize if you had a hard time getting in today. As you probably heard, they're shooting Sex and the City, the movie, today, tomorrow, and Friday. And the Enterprise has completely, if entertainingly, made a mess of this place. They're doing it actually right outside the shooting is going on the stairs going from the second to the third floor, which is right outside the center. So you can see all the actresses sitting there getting their makeup put on. And this afternoon, Carrie Bradshaw in her wedding dress got married, or almost got married. I hope I don't get sued by the film company. I'm spoiling it. Shall I spoil it or should I say no more? Okay, I won't say any more. Except that, well, never mind. Yeah, right. It's quite a dress. You'll find this card which lists the other programs we have coming up in the next couple of months. It's on the table at the exit as you leave. Next Tuesday, the novelist Joyce Carol Oates will be interviewing Edmund White, who was a fellow at the Kullman Center and wrote a novel while he was here called Hotel de Dream. That's Tuesday the 16th. And later on in the fall, we'll be hosting conversations about the writer Leonard Michaels, about two slaves who escaped from the South during the Civil War, and about a new best-selling novel called Redemption Falls by the Irish writer Joseph O'Connor, who will talk with his fellow Foreman Kullman Center fellow. I was worried about tripping on that. Another best-selling Irish novelist, Colm McCann. So you can find dates and times for all of those on this program, Murder in the Stacks, which, I don't know, well. Special thanks to Betsy Bradley, the Kullman Center's Manager of Public Programs, for setting up and managing all of these events, including tonight's, which brings us to Julia Child in America. Melanie Rahak, the moderator for the evening, wrote her own best-selling book, Nancy Drew and the Women Who Created Her, while she was a fellow at the Kullman Center. The book won the Edgar and Agatha Awards and was named one of the best books of the year by the Chicago Tribune for 2005. Melanie's currently working on a book that will be called Meet the Farmer, Food, Family, and Balancing the World, One Meal at a Time. As you might guess from the title, it will be about local farming and will follow various kinds of food from growing in the earth to arriving on the plate. What's not evident in the title is that the story will be a first-person account, part of it based on Melanie's work in the kitchen of Applewood, a great small restaurant in Park Slope. If she weren't here tonight, she'd be cooking fish at Applewood. And if you haven't eaten there, I really recommend it. Melanie will introduce the panelists, and I'll turn the mic over to her in just a second, but I want to add that books by the four panelists will be on sale just outside the doors also as you leave. The authors have agreed to sign copies, so please let them get out back to the hallway after they speak and buy the books and ask them your follow-up questions there. Thank you.
Hi, thanks for coming. I'm going to do a quick introduction of our four panelists so we can hear what they have to say. David Camp, to my right, is the author of The United States of Arugula, How We Became a Gourmet Nation, which is a great book for anyone who wants to know why you can buy sushi at your corner market and what a salt tasting is, which I found kind of interesting, and which was also named one of the New York Times 100 most notable books for 2006. He's a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and at GQ, where he recently wrote not about Sylvester Stallone, which was what I thought, but about Sly Stone of the Family Stone. That was a very critical conversation we just had backstage. And his new humor book, which is called The Food Snobs Dictionary, An Essential Lexicon of Gastronomical Knowledge, co-authored by Marion Rosenfeld, just came out yesterday, so you want to rush right out and buy it. And according to that book, which I think is very appropriate for this evening, it will give ordinary folk the wherewithal to take down the food snobs, which Julia Child would surely have appreciated. To his right is Laura Shapiro, whose most recent book is Julia Child, published in the Penguin Live series, which is an acclaimed brief biography of tonight's reason for being here. She is a former senior writer for Newsweek, where she covered food, books, and the arts, and has also written for the New York Times, Gourmet, and Gastronomica. And she is the recipient of a James Beard Journalism Award. In addition to her new biography of Julia Child, she's also the author of two other food-related books, Perfection Salad, Women and Cooking at the Turn of the Century, and Something from the Oven, Reinventing Dinner in 1950s America. Like her Julia biography, both of those books are about a lot more than just food and cooking in America. They cover social and historical contexts of our great national culinary journey, and I'm sure she'll help us learn more about that tonight as it pertains to Julia. To her right is Molly O'Neill, who is most recently the editor of American Food Writing, an anthology with classic recipes published by the Library of America, a really kind of incredible book that includes everything from George Washington Carver's recipe for puree of peanuts number 2, extra fine, which he allows, I couldn't resist telling you all this, makes a generous layer between slices of bread makes an excellent sandwich. To Julia Child's essay about how her TV show, The French Chef, began, which begins that she ended up on television by accident, so maybe we'll be able to talk about that a little bit tonight, too. Molly is also a former food columnist for the New York Times and the author of several cookbooks, including the award-winning New York cookbook and one of my favorites, The Well-Seasoned Appetite, as well as a memoir. And finally, to her right is Dan Barber, who is the chef and co-owner of Blue Hill Restaurant here in New York, which just received its first Michelin star, and Blue Hill at Stone Barns, which is upstate in Westchester County. He also serves as creative director of the Stone Barns Center for Food and Agriculture, which is committed to sustainable community-based agriculture and to educating all of us about what that means, with a lot of great programs for children and for adults. The farm raises free-range animals, one of which is in the back of Dan's car outside right now, which I'm probably not supposed to tell you, but and also produce year-round, and they have a 22,000 square foot greenhouse which they use during the winter, and you can eat all of that stuff at both of the restaurants, both upstate and here. And in addition to all of this, Dan is also a recipient of the James Beard Award for Best Chef in New York City. So that's who these people are, and sadly I have no introduction for this fine creature, but our fifth and final guest, maybe it's the perfect introduction for her. So we thought we would start the evening off with a little taste of what Laura refers to in her book on Julia as Julia's joyful fanaticism, a phrase that really stuck with me. So we'll start the first clip, and I hope somebody back there is listening to me.
Look at this magnificent head. It's from a giant cod. And here is a hake frame. We're going to do fish soup and bouillabaisse today on The French Chef. Welcome to The French Chef. I'm Julia Child. Today we're going to do fish soup and bouillabaisse. Bouillabaisse is probably one of the most famous of all French soups. It originated on the Mediterranean coast of France in Marseille. And all it is really is a plain fisherman's stew made out of the day's catch or the unsalable leftovers. Unfortunately, when you get a famous recipe like this, the gourmets get hold of it, and they fancy it up so much and say, do this, do that, or that's not the real thing, that us ordinary people feel that it's impossible to do and terribly expensive. But you can make a bouillabaisse out of any kind of fresh, lean fish that you want. And it's wonderful to eat, and everybody enjoys making it, and particularly eating it, and there's nothing very difficult about it. Now, first, The first thing that you do when you want to make a fish soup or a bouillabaisse is to make a great fish stock.
Oops. Well, that was rather abrupt. Every time I see that, I feel like we should have invited a social linguist onto the panel just to talk about how Julia says the word gourmets. So I feel like so much untapped material there. But since we haven't, we'll turn to these fine people. And maybe, Laura, you want to start us off on Julia and who she was and why this woman became so popular right away in American culture.
This bouillabaisse clip is actually a great way to introduce Julia, because bouillabaisse was kind of a fetish of hers, starting back when she was living in Paris and had gone to the Cordon Bleu, and she had met Simca and Louise Bertol, her colleagues there, and they were working on this big French cookbook for Americans that would become Mastering the Art of French Cooking. And while she was working on the book, and being Julia, her way of working on the book was to take every recipe, every traditional recipe, every recipe of Simca's, every recipe from Escoffier or any other book, and tear it apart and deconstruct it and redo it from every possible angle and try to make it come out right every single time and be the perfect example of that. So she was an incredibly hands-on plus academic cook. In that time, she was also a Foreign Service wife. Her husband, Paul, was working for the State Department in Paris, so they had this social life, and they were always meeting and spending time with the French people in Paris, who paid no, it's hard to believe now, they paid no attention to Julia, and they didn't think that she was an interesting or important person because she was A, American, and B, interested in cooking. Well, isn't that nice? And it was sort of a pat on the head, though. It was a pat on the head. So, and this infuriated her. They were condescending to this nice little housewife who was working on recipes. She could, run them six times around the room with what she knew about bouillabaisse, but they would insist that to make a bouillabaisse, and this was one of her examples all the time when she raged about this in letters, you had to be a grizzled old Frenchman, a fisherman in some coastal town, and you had to have exactly this fish, and you had to, you know, pull this sprig of something out of the ground exactly for that. She thought this was ridiculous. So her idea, and she says this when she writes about bouillabaisse always, is it's fresh fish, it's this, it's saffron, whatever, it's anise, and you, those are the flavors, it's going to be French, you can do it. You don't have to be French. You don't have to have gone to cooking school to do it. It's yours. You can do it. So that's what she's doing here.
And Dan, maybe you can tell us.
I'm not Dan, though.
Oh, sorry. I'm sorry. Oh, my God. That's Julia okay. Would be so. Although, actually, Julia would probably
just make the most of it.
Exactly. David. Maybe you can put this into a little bit of context for us. You write a lot in your book about what was going on when Julia came along. And
well, it was the post-war era, and it was actually a very francophilic era. I kind of view it wistfully because now we hear about the French as cheese-eating surrender monkeys, and they're, you know, reflexively derided, and we're supposed to hate them. But it was actually mutual, and, you know, and the French reciprocated it in the post-war era. And this was kind of a natural outgrowth of that, about Americans becoming more aspirational. And there really hasn't been an era like it before or since in terms of mutual admiration and respect between the French and the Americans. And then to what she did was she took on this seemingly undemystifiable thing that was French cookery and said, you know, the populism in that clip, that anyone can do it. And in fact, this would set hearts aflutter now, but I think when she talks about making bouillabaisse, she says, I believe in Mastering the Art of French Cooking, you can use some canned clam juice if you don't have such and such available to you. But that was part of it, too, is that she really was trying to take away any intimidation factor whatsoever. And that was brilliant of her, but it was also brilliant timing, because she hit this moment when ordinary, literal G.I. Joes, you know, were going to France, traveling because airfare was cheap, and were willing to take on this idea of cooking without being intimidated. And she took away that intimidation factor.
Well, Dan, no, I know I have that right.
I'm certainly not intimidated.
There's only two of you.
I don't know if that's a good
as arguably a gourmet, can you speak to...
But a gourmand at heart.
A gourmand, exactly. Could you speak to that issue of, you know, how Julia wanted to make food approachable? And
yeah, I'm not sure I have quite the historical perspective David does.
But you have the chef
But I'm going to lord it over you.
Yeah, she opened doors. You know, my generation doesn't have a direct connection to her in the sense of watching that and being inspired directly. But I can see just from that clip how it's influenced chefs like me today and trying in our approach to food, both in the kitchen and in front of the live audience, to make what we do accessible and friendly and approachable. And that's a gift that I think she handed down to us in a way that opened up the kitchen beyond creating the perfect plate of food and beyond being imprisoned by the kitchen. And she gave rise to the Wolfgang Pucks of the world. And today you see her influence everywhere. So it was really refreshing to see that.
Just wait, there's more.
Right.
And Molly, maybe you could talk a little bit about what she did for Home Chefs. I mean, and just how that show went into American airspace. And I mean, you know, some of the fan mail she got, it's as though she, you know, had released, as Dan said, released people from their chains. And you sort of have this image of, you know, American women in front of the TV set, you know, just waiting to
right.
learn more from her.
Right. Nora Ephron did a wonderful take on what happened in the years after, you know, as soon as Julia began airing, and suddenly the shift went from discussing the ballet to discussing the poulet. And, you know, it happened, and everyone was making the same recipes, and they were fairly derivative of the French chef.
Can you give us some examples?
Yeah, I mean, suddenly everybody thought they could make a baguette, and Julia's recipe was like 12
terrifying.
Pages long. It was hilarious. I remember one time as a tribute to Julia, I wanted to run it in the New York Times, but there weren't that many ad pages. I mean, the magazine would have weighed 5 pounds. It was insane. The other thing that's really interesting to me, I mean, there were a couple things that were very interesting to me. I always forget what a klutz she was. And I worked with Julia. I lived across the street from her in Cambridge. I learned she was incredibly generous to me when I was coming up. And she was a real battleship in the kitchen. But I forget that on camera, too, that was one of her great thing. I mean, she's just such a real person with her getting her cleaver out, put that down, and then those big hands. I mean, her hands were like these teamster, these stevedore hands. And then, you know, that chirpy, warbling voice. And then, you know, her whole thing about speaking for the proletariat and speaking for the common person and none of those gourmets for us. To me, the irony is that she took fine food from the professional class and brought it into the middle class household and made it part of daily vernacular. But she also created a generation of Dan Barbers. And so we're seeing it move, that fine cooking is moving back to the professional kitchens. And I see, you know, the kind of science cooking mm-hmm. as a way of doing that. Let's keep it here. Let's make the divide. Mm-hmm. We always have to create that distinction, that distinction, that distinction. And I think that Julia, I love to think sometimes, well, what would she say about this? Sometimes I channel her.
Sometimes we all channel
yes.
her, don't we?
It's true, this business of making these recipes available to ordinary people and loosening up the kitchen and so forth, that all happened. But she had a great little streak of, I don't want to call it elitism, but
oh.
when
I will.
When Craig Claiborne did that famous, had that famous story, it was on the front page of the New York Times in the early 70s, he had won a $4,000 dinner anywhere in the world, and he and Pierre Frenet went to Paris and this restaurant, and they ran a story about going to this dinner and in the early 70s paying $4,000 for it. You could send your kid to college for that in those days. And the letters poured in. People were outraged. The Times ran letters for weeks on this thing. Julia, there's a letter from her to Craig Claiborne writing to him and saying, they're crazy. What are they complaining about? These are people who have mink coats and big cars. That's what they're spending their money on. Why shouldn't you spend your money on this food? Whether or not she really believed that, I don't know. She had a funny thing about Craig Claiborne. She was real nice to him, and she also criticized him, you know, with the other on the other side. But
Do you think, I mean, it brings up an interesting point, which is that she was accused more than once, I'm sure, of being a food snob. And was that, maybe you can speak to this, David?
I don't think she was necessarily. I thought she was really more of the anti-elitist. In fact, she is, you know, on paper as elite as you get, born to a well-to-do Pasadena family, educated at Smith, and she met her husband while in the OSS, which was a haven of rich preppies and all that. But the thing that got across about her, that's sort of the biggest fear that a lot of ordinary people have in crossing over into embracing better food and, you know, farm to table and all that stuff. Oh, it seems so elitist. It seems so, you know, intimidating. And she somehow, despite this so-called on-paper elitist background, had the streak of populism that was the complete opposite of what her background was. Mm-hmm. And so she wasn't a food snob. And in fact, that way she delivered the word gourmet, right. You know, she torpedoed that word.
Right. Well, what about the idea? I mean, she was a huge supporter of the food industry, and Safeway even sponsored the French Chef for a long time. And I mean, it seems so the opposite, and Dan, maybe you have some thoughts about this, of what we think of as, you know, good food or fine food now. I mean, her whole idea, as David mentioned, was that, you know, you could make it with canned, you know, clam juice, or, right. And it was fine. And right. It seems like now, you know, we're all coming back to the idea that, you know, if you can't buy it at a green market, I mean, you could do it in a pinch, but you don't really want to use it. I mean, how do those things?
Well, she strikes me as very political. I mean, she knew what who her constituency was, and she was going after that. I'd like to think that she didn't actually believe in the kinds of things that, you know, supported big agriculture. Although there are quite a few examples, and you could probably reference them much more readily than I can, where she spoke in favor of those corporate interests, and whether they were sponsoring her or not is from what I understand.
Mm-hmm. She was very, very, very much for large corporate food interests, and very intimidated toward the end of her life about a number of things that, if were the truth told today, would cast her in a less favorable light. There were a few political things that, as a diehard liberal Democrat, she stumbled on. And there were huge things in the food industry. I mean, a couple things that I remember when PETA started going crazy about the milk. Remember with Primo Veal and,
sure.
and that whole thing. I went to a veal farm with her, and it was a nightmare. It was a nightmare. I mean, it was like being in a Holocaust. It was horrible. And she said, I see nothing wrong with this place. What are they talking about? I mean, it was horrible. And when I, you know.
All right,
when
Laura and Dan, you guys are up next for the Julia impression. Okay, just so you know. Two down, two to go.
The tide began to shift in America away from very meat-heavy dishes to kind of lighter dishes, and the use of vegetables became more pronounced, and the use of carbohydrates became more pronounced. Every Sunday morning, this is back in the days of the answering machine, every Sunday morning when I was writing at the New York Times, the answering machine would go off. Julia woke up very early and was accustomed to talking to me early. So 6:15, bing, is that Molly? Has those vegetarians gotten to you? I see no meat in your column today. We need to be careful, dear.
Now, that was really it. It was not for her constituency. Her constituency was your constituency, and they were appalled by some of the things that Julia got around to saying. She would get these letters, Julia, how could you? You're promoting genetic engineering. You're in favor of MSG.
And irradiated food.
Yes,
she was
irradiated. Oh, she did, but it wasn't. She believed the things that the food industry said, and she had a history of believing them. Again, when she was in Paris, when she had questions about food for the book, she would write these letters to the Rice Council and the dairy industry.
Right, get their answers. The irony in that, of course, is that the kinds of things she was talking about, classic French food, is rooted in great agriculture.
Right.
Organic agriculture, of course, before the word was even invented, but great fundamentals and heritage wisdom.
She thought that was the least important thing in the world.
Yeah, it's incredible.
I kind of give her a little bit of a pass on that just because of the era and generation she was. It's sort of like, I don't begrudge a 90-year-old for saying that all rock music is noise. You know, it's the same. it's the same. She had a very specific battle that she chose and won handily with America, which was just, hey, don't be intimidated by cooking. Don't be intimidated by good food or by French food, which then can be a gateway to other kinds of sophisticated or aspirational or adventurous cooking and eating. And so that was her battle, and she took it on and won it handily and really convinced the whole of America pretty much that that was worthwhile. She was, you know, by our standards, wrong about ingredients. You can do it all in the supermarket. No, you can't if you really care. But like I said, that was sort of... It would be sort of like beating up on a 90-year-old for not liking the Rolling Stones.
Don't you think that her attacks on Alice Waters, for example, was a direct appeal to the masses who view Alice Waters, and I don't mean to single her out, but those who are precious about Dan Barber's, if I had been around at that point, I approach this with too much of a sensibility and a preciousness that wouldn't appeal to the kinds of people that she was trying to turn on to food. Am I wrong on that?
I don't think it was not about the masses or her audience at all. It was that she thought Alice was out of her mind. The idea that you had to be committed to picking every peach from the tree to, you know, and that the peach counted as dessert. What is it? It was not her thing.
Well, do you think lazy people? She doesn't even cook it.
Do you think, Dan, that she could survive today? I mean, with this show?
Well, there are a lot of chefs that I know of today who embrace that and view Alice with that same kind of pretentiousness that I just mentioned and feel like, you know, that's something that's a little bit backward and unrealistic, especially for our climate in the Northeast, but also just for the general home cook. So there's something that I think is embracing about what Julie represented for a lot of chefs, ironically, because of also our haute imperative as well. So it can get quite confusing when you examine it.
I think the objection was something different. I think the objection was one of style. I think that what Julia didn't like about Alice is that Alice lives out of her head. And Julia lives out of her heart and her hands. And she wanted joy. She wanted a robust feeling. She didn't want things parsed and tiny and Tiffany'd. She wanted things to be accessible. And I think that that's what it was really about. And that the battle line happened to be about products is incredibly unfortunate. But I don't think that that's what motivated her in that battle.
I would agree with Molly, too. That I think that with Julia, it really was about just enthusiasm, infectious enthusiasm, whereas with Alice Waters, it's about a noble ideal. And I think Julia, to this day, I think her approach as a politician was much better because, you know, she won all of us over. Whereas with Alice Waters, honestly, she comes out on a stage at some event. Some people hunch over. They feel guilt-tripped just by the very sight of it. And, you know, the beret and everything. And I think, honestly, we need more people who have Alice Waters' ideals but more of a Julia approach to popularizing them. You know, if we could somehow morph them in some tube thing.
All right. Well, along those lines, we have another clip. Mysterious clip showers in the back room.
charred. And one thing that's nice about this, too, you can add other things to it, such as some of these cooked diced onions. And we had them the other night with onions and cooked diced green pepper.
Sorry, I should say she's making
a
potato pancake.
It was an awful good mixture. And another thing you could do would be diced ham or chicken livers or diced mushrooms. I hope that's... I'm going to try and flip this over, which is a rather daring thing to do, but you have got to get a little bit of a crust on the bottom of it. Now, another thing that you can do with this is to have a fireproof dish and get the bottom nice and crusty, and then pour some very heavy cream and sprinkle a little cheese on top of it, and then bake that in the oven for about, in a 375 oven for about 30 minutes. That makes a perfectly delicious dish. I'm going to see if that is flippable. Oh, well, I'm going to try it anyway. When you flip anything, you just have to have the courage of your convictions, particularly if it's sort of a loose mass like this. Well, that didn't go very well. See, when I flipped it, I didn't have the courage to do it the way I should have. But you can always pick it up, and if you're alone in the kitchen, who is going to see? But the only way you learn...
All right, it almost bears no comment, but... So I'm not sure if everyone could hear over the raucous laughter from the room, but that was the very famous clip in which she says, "You are alone in the kitchen. If you are alone in the kitchen, who is going to see?" Something I have often brought to mind when I've had a big disaster during a dinner party. But why is that? I mean, this is maybe the most remembered Julia moment of all of her shows, and maybe we could talk a little bit about that and a little bit about why this woman who, as you said, was such a klutz and just did things wrong constantly on her show was still such an idol and became such a sort of cooking guru for so many people.
I was trying to imagine Rachel Ray doing that.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, and maybe, I mean, since you bring it up, maybe we can sort of merge all these conversations together and talk about how different that is from what we see now on food TV and what we expect from celebrity chefs and Food Network shows and, you know, so.
Well, the Food Network vetting process now would never allow a 6'2" woman with a warbly voice and breathing in the wrong places. I always liken her to, like, her contemporary Howard Cosell in the sports world. Brooklyn Jewish lawyer talks like this, whatever, you know, that, and you know, no. Again, no ABC executive now would allow that man to make it even into the reception, let alone an on-camera screen test. And so it's just, there's something to be said for oddball charisma, which is what both those people had. And it was so infectious, and I think it was part of her populist appeal, too. It was just that she wasn't a Donna Reed-type perfect kitchen character, which is what that era prescribed, you know?
Amazing thing about this clip and this moment, which is the famous moment from Julia's whole television career, all those years, this is the thing everyone remembers, and they remember it wrong. People will say, they've come up to me and said, and they'll say to anybody, "I saw her drop a chicken on the floor and put it back. I saw her drop a turkey. I saw her drop three ducks on the floor, a huge fish, and she put it right back, and she said, 'You're alone in the kitchen. Who is going to see?'" So they get the quote right, but the food has grown. It's just blossomed in their memories.
That's great.
So I, in working on my book, I wrestled with that. You know, what is it? What are we trying to remember? What do we have to remember that makes us expand that incident to include these gigantic things of food and Julia bringing it back? And I feel as though the incident has to be as big as Julia, as big as our memory of Julia, that she's such an outsized figure in our television memory and our culinary memory, that that somehow that little incident had to be the same size. But it is remarkable. People, some of you probably remember seeing her drop a chicken, but I promise you it didn't happen.
And also that the Dan Aykroyd parody, I think it was like...
Right.
Yeah. It was like 78, by which time she had not filmed an original show in something like 5-6 years, right? So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, and
yes,
that, and that it was still that relevant and that gettable to a young TV comedy-watching stoner audience, probably, and that they would still get a Julia Child joke because she was that big.
Yeah. Well, Dan, what do you think? I mean, you're, you know, the only person here who has to function. I don't know if you ever cook in front of an audience, but, I mean, do you feel that now there's really a culture...
20-year-old testosterone-driven young chefs that I cook around all day.
Right, right. But, I mean, do you feel there's pressure to...
a national audience.
To perform, you know, to execute your knife skills and your everything, your flips, you know, perfectly, or...
Do I feel the pressure to...
Yeah.
I mean, you wouldn't find me attempting to do something like that in my kitchen, unless they came along. My audience, I say that with some kind of truth. I mean, I feel tremendous pressure around my young coterie of cooks because they do look to me as if I know how to cook, you know, flip the perfect
as if
potato pancake. And so the humanizing around this group doesn't happen too often. And so I tend to take on a testosterone-driven manliness myself, to be honest. And those kind of clips are more instructive than you think.
So do you think something's been lost? I mean,
I think a lot's been lost. Obviously, when you see that, and food, you know, the network seems to me more about fetishizing food than it is about what everyone's described today, which is the love of good food and the love of the company that surrounds it and the kinds of things that Julia represented and that. We ought to return to, but it seems as if the Food Network is going the other direction in food shows. So, you know, it's a little perplexing to see this next to a Rachel Ray show.
Mm-hmm. Molly, did you want to say something or just having a laugh?
No, I just thought it would have been so funny to see them cooking together.
Yeah. Well, one thing Julia would have cooked with Rachel Ray, the very last print interview she gave, she sang Emeril Lagasse's praises, and she was not, you know, scandalized by the fact that he was so flagrantly commercial, because that again was her populism kicking in. And my sense is that Rachel Ray would not have offended her. She would have found a way to defend Rachel Ray.
She probably would have. But the thing about Julia's mistakes is that she herself hated them. They were the thing that everybody loved best. Right. And in fact, they were incredibly useful for an audience to see. You saw her mending that potato thing. But so she recognized, she knew that was like a teachable moment, and it was good to have it. She hated it. They made her cringe. That was going to be on reruns for the rest of her life. And she was a huge perfectionist. She thought of herself as a total professional. She had studied with chefs. She wanted to do it right. She thought that good teaching was showing them how to do it right. It killed her to see things like that just out there over and over. And the very quality that we love in that show and about Julia, the klutziness, the things go wrong and stuff, drove her nuts. And it's why, in the course of her career, the shows got glossier and glossier and more rehearsed. She did less cooking. They got sillier and less interesting until you could just see a huge change from the beginning to the end of her career because of that. But she liked them better. She thought that they were better the smoother they are and the more professional.
Just to go back to something you said about your testosterone-driven masculinity, the other thing that strikes me, Rachel Ray aside, is that, of course, Julia was a woman, and I feel like a lot of the chefs that we really hold in high esteem right now are men, you know, yourself included, but anyone from, you know, Mario Batali to Emeril Lagasse or whoever. And I mean, do you think, is there room?
When you say we hold them in regard, I mean, I don't.
We the non-chefs. You know, if you think of names who are big enough to exist on a kind of national level, Food Network people, you know, kind of household chef names, you know, a thing which didn't really exist prior to pretty recently, with the exception of Julia. And maybe someone like Alice Waters, who I guess we've all agreed is of another time-space continuum. I mean, why are there no women now? Why since you have a...
Well, did you want to chime in on that as a woman?
I prefer to do it as a woman than as a man. I mean, we...
Sorry, I didn't mean to put you
on
the spot.
No, really. This is why I don't moderate these things.
I mean, I think a couple things are going on here. We're dramatically overlooking Martha. And
good point.
I'm sorry, but you can put 55 Mario Batalis in a can and you do not have Martha. By any way of judging, except taste. Right? And, you know, so much of what the Food Network is doing is totally derivative. No one's come up with anything new since this woman. No one is taking any risks. They're not allowed to. The production values are so extraordinarily high. The cost of doing... when I was doing stuff for public television, I believe that the budget was $300,000 for 30 minutes, and we were using... BBC footage. I mean, it's an insane amount of money that goes into doing, and so it has to be committee controlled. And, you know, yes, there's a significant gender problem, and Laura and I have had real some great lunches on this subject, prepared by men. Danielle Ballou. But I think that the issue is something different. It's about there's one thing happens, it changes the world, and then the world imitates that thing until the next great thing happens. And in this, the next great thing hasn't happened yet. We're all riding her coattails. At least that's what I think.
Do you agree with that? Or?
Mm.
As a man,
thank you. I was going to say that's a broad statement. I just want to go back to your point about that question. Why are there not more women to which we supposedly emulate in the kitchen? It kind of goes back to why aren't there more female chefs running top kitchens?
I mean, I guess that's really I certainly don't mean to discount Martha Stewart,
but
somebody of
your
sort
question.
Of restaurant empire. Cookbook kind of category.
Well, the women chefs that I admire are not cooking the kind of food that gets the 4 stars and the multiple restaurants and the backing to do restaurants in environments that get those kind of reviews and then get that kind of backing. It's kind of contagious. So there are a lot of fantastic women chefs out there. And in fact, in my kitchens, at Blue Hill New York and Blue Hill at Stone Barns, I prefer hiring women. We get quite a few through, and a lot choose not to work the hours and the intensity. But I have 30 to 40% women in, which is
That's
triple
high.
The number of most mm-hmm. kitchens. And because I look for it, I mean, it's a sort of reverse sexism or whatever. Because I do feel like when somebody can take the hours and the pressure, when a woman can take the hours and the pressure, Jenna, this is a very broad stroke comment to make, but I feel like the passion, the reason for them being there is much more about the food and about where the food's coming from and about the sensibility and the whole gestalt is the whole package is much more real than when usually this testosterone younger male driven chef is there for the resume and for the for the prestige of working with me supposedly or with Blue Hill. So I hope
it's
maybe
ego,
I'm doing something
versus...
to change that. I don't know, but I'm doing it out of self interest because I really think they produce women on my cooking lines produce better food.
Yeah. Well, this is a little far afield from Julia Child, but on the West Coast, actually, a lot of visionary chefs have been women, like. Deborah Madison at Green's, the vegetarian mm-hmm. restaurant, Judy Rogers at Zuni Cafe, Susan Feniger and Mary Sue Milliken.
And Suzanne Gorin,
and Nancy Silverton, for whom you worked, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, there are quite a few out there, but somehow they're all on the West Coast. Not all, but a lot of them. I'm sorry, I was going to set Laura up. I'm just going to set you up with something. which is that, to tie it back to Julia didn't really like women chefs, did she? She was a man's woman.
She liked women chefs, but her idea of greatness was generally focused on men. We did not invent this male-centered food world that we now live in. Julia was hoping and praying for it. It was her idea that unless you got men at center stage in the food world, it was never going to be a great culinary preoccupation and the subject of all conversations and so forth the way it was in France, and that's what she was aiming for. So, plus, she just liked men. She really did. She was a big flirt, and she just had this thing for men. It sounds so outlandish now, but nobody does anymore, but...
But that's for a different panel, Laura.
Anyway, she would light up when the men came in the room. When letters came in from a male fan, she and Paul would read them, and she'd write these nice personal notes back. So great to hear from a man. I always think it makes such a difference to have a man in the kitchen. So she was just like that, and she would have appreciated this. At the same time, if you were a good cook, it didn't matter what sex you were, she was for you, and she promoted a lot of women chefs, and she worked to get them into the Culinary Institute of America. She was definitely for women being in the profession, so it wasn't that she was against them. She just loved men.
All right, well, on that note, we're going to show one more clip, which is Julia and some tools, so it's very appropriate. So,
then, no matter what way you're going to cook it, it should have a butter massage. If you had rendered chicken fat, you could give it a rendered chicken fat massage. And I really think the actual massage is very beneficial to it because it gets right into that skin and it gives it a lovely flavor and it helps it brown nicely. And then you can roast this as it is now. You can poach it, or you can roast it the old-fashioned way in the oven, or you can roast it on the spit. And we're going to roast it on the spit because that is not only the most ancient, but also the most modern way to roast a chicken. And here's the spit. I think it's useful to know how to put the chicken on a spit. So you make sure that it's good and tight at this end. And then you always start on from the neck end. And I'll show you why later. And that's those prongs. If the prongs don't fit in very well, you can always bend them. But you want to get the prongs right into the chicken. And then you get the other end on. And that's supposed to go right square into those bones, because it's just got to hold that on. And then screw that up tight. I always believe in having plenty of tools in the kitchen. So I think what we can do is just get a pair of pliers and really hold that on. Because if you don't get the chicken well enough onto the spit, it shrinks a little bit sometimes as it cooks, and it also can come off the spit too easily, and then you have a terrible problem of a hot chicken and a hot spit and juice dripping, and it's just a mess. So just remember, get it securely on. And the reason that you have it on...
All right. I think the thing where she brings out the pliers may be my personal favorite. Man, you just wait for her to have some kind of fancy cooking gadget, and no, she's gone into the toolbox. So I think this is a great clip because it shows really how practical Julia was on top of everything else and how much she cared about teaching. I mean, she's so involved in all the, right before this section is, you see her tie up the whole chicken with about 5 yards of string and she makes it all look incredibly easy and the chicken is perfect afterwards. And, you know, I watched it and thought, you know, she's got to be kidding. I could never do this. And yet she still made me feel like if I just practiced enough, I could probably do it. So let's talk about her as a teacher, because this was something that I think was very important to her that, you know, maybe we've also lost a little bit now, and I think was a huge part of you know, why we're still here talking about her now. So who wants to? Molly?
Well, let's see. She was a fantastic teacher, but there was a need for a teacher at that time. I mean, it's not only that she was just a natural teacher. In fact, if I'm thinking, I'm kind of casting back, and I'm thinking of her kitchen in Cambridge, which didn't have one piece of fancy equipment in it. And she really thought that fancy stoves and all that, she thought it was a bunch of hooey, and that you should just have things that worked. And she had a piece of pegboard with everything outlined, because it drove her nuts that people didn't put things back in the right, you know, here's where the nutcracker goes, and here's where the zester goes, and here's where the whisk goes. And but it was very simple and not fancy. Her stuff had old chipped enameled handles on it and stuff like that. And as I'm thinking about being in that room and of her as a teacher, she was not this brilliant technician. Laura's going to probably get incredibly mad at me right now, but Julia was not a very good cook. She really wasn't. And I ate her food a lot of times. She was not a brilliant cook. She wasn't even a particularly talented cook. What she was a woman who had great joy. And she knew how to talk about it, and she knew how to talk you through it. So if she would see me doing something that could be bettered, as I was watching this, I remembered Julia was the one who said to me, it kind of ties all this together. We were doing some chickens one time, and they were from Safeway. They were horrible. And I was cooking in restaurants and used good food products, and I was looking at these things and just despairing, because we were doing a fundraising dinner for Radcliffe. And I thought, oh, God, you know, it's just going to be a nightmare. And she said, oh, no, dear, we're just going to get a lot of butter, and we're going to shove it under the skin. So in addition to the massage, we were shoving butter, between the skin and the flesh, all over the bird, not just the breastbone. And she was a very patient teacher. But, you know, she kind of showed me one thing, and then about five birds later, she came by and said, oh, yeah, you're much better than I am. You have better hands than I do, but you're going to like that butter idea. And to me, that's what was great about her. She wasn't great technically. She wasn't a terrific cook, but she knew the right place to be, and she knew how to meet a cook, you know, where how to tell you this is what you need to do now. This is how to use your hands today. And because of that, and because we needed as a nation to be reminded how to cook, she was kind of a perfect, forgive me, but kindergarten teacher. This is not heavy lifting. This is really elementary stuff. Sorry.
I think.
All right, Laura.
No, I think I remember that bit where she trusses the chicken. Yeah, it's elementary if you're a chef. It is a degree from MIT if you're a regular person. That was big time teaching. That was big time teaching. And Julia was our great cooking teacher because she was our great cooking student. She had learned to cook because she couldn't when she started. She was not a natural cook. Nothing came easily or well to her, and that's maybe what you see happening. She couldn't cook when she started. She had to learn, and she learned at the Cordon Bleu, where it was very, very cut and dried and very rigorous and very technical. That made her a cook, and that's what she believed in. That's what she trusted, were those techniques and learning that way. And she did it because she wanted her husband Paul to be happy, really. So it was love and going to school and learning this thing. And that was like the size and shape of her career. Mm-hmm. And she always loved learning, and that's what made her a good teacher year after year. I was once in that kitchen with her when she had its little TV on, and Wolfgang Puck was doing one of these things. I thought to myself, Wolfgang Puck, who cares about him? I'm not going to pay attention to that. When it was over, 2 minutes later, Julia said, wasn't that amazing? I go, yeah. She said, you know, you can always learn something. I felt like such an idiot. I had ignored it. But she had picked something up because she always could learn something. She always paid attention.
One of the leitmotifs of when I was interviewing people in the food world, especially talking about the food pioneers in America, James Beard, Craig Claiborne, and Julia, and even Alice Waters, a lot of people who knew them would say, yeah, but you know what? He or she didn't have kitchen chops. It was like the big secret, didn't have kitchen shops. It doesn't diminish their legacy, any of those four people I mentioned, because they each obviously got across in some major way, despite being far less technically accomplished than Wiley Dufresne or someone like that. You
know? Yeah. Well, the biggest debt, I think, to chefs just from hearing all of this and thinking about it in the context of, you know, the chef's perspective is you look at the three, you know, I'll take this, I think I'd say this, the three biggest chef names today, the Wolfgang Puck on the West Coast, the Mario Batali all over the place, maybe Emeril, those three, all of them owe the greatest debt to her, not because of their cooking abilities. In fact, one could question their cooking abilities, as David just said, and their chops in the kitchen, but their love of and passion for food is directly, this is so straight linked to her. That it seems inarguable to suggest that they couldn't be in the place they are today without her opening those doors. It reminds me of that just watching these clips.
All right, well, I think that's a great place to end. We're going to take a few questions, about 10 minutes of questions, and or less, 5 minutes of questions. and Betsy has a microphone, and if you would just address it to whoever you were addressing it to, that would be great.
Hi, you spoke early on about Julia Child's regard for Safeway and for Big Food and her bewilderment at someone like Alice Waters and her regard for ingredients. Did she also have any connection with the source of the food, and did she, for example, ever shoot a segment of her show on location on a farm, or was that completely lost on her?
Yeah. Later in her career, she did more of that. That was the part of her television career where she was sort of standing around saying things while other people did the stuff of the show. She knew it was important. She understood the difference between a good ingredient and a bad ingredient. But that thing that Alice has that kind of drives you to the ground to pull the radish out by the root, she didn't have that. She did it on TV a little bit, but she didn't have it.
Anyone else?
And to defend Alice, she could have done more in that area. And could have done a lot to awaken people to the kinds of things that Alice talks about, probably, as David said, in a way that was more appealing than Alice herself.
But she absolutely refused to. Yeah.
But one thing we're overlooking is that there was a degradation in the quality of the product happened gradually over a lifetime. And, you know, Alice went to France and suddenly it was Helen Keller at the well. This is what chicken's supposed to taste like. And when a thing degrades over a period of decades, she'd already picked her battle, as we've said here. And so to circle back, I'm not sure is even 100% possible.
Hi. You spoke a little bit about Julia Child's legacy in terms of being a television chef, but I was wondering whether or not any of the panelists could talk a little bit about her legacy in terms of being a cookbook author and what she did for American writers in terms of making the cookbook something different than what it was before.
Well, those of us who are deadline offenders are very, very grateful to Julia. Because mastering the art of French cooking took
7 years at least. 7 years of writing, nine in all.
It was a 16-year project altogether, and so, you know, that's kind of a wonderful thing when you're slogging through trying to deliver something on time and you suddenly realize, oh my God, I've overlooked this whole thing. My fantasy is always, this is the Julia moment. This is what'll make it great. And, I mean, also, I think, yes, Julia gave us a lot, but so did Judith, her editor. Between the two of them, they changed the form of cookbooks. And it was a very important moment. If you look at recipes before Julia and then after Julia, the form changed. And it became it became much more conversant, but it's still a very elegant form. and it's arranged intuitively. The changes are really subtle, but they're incredibly effective. And we still are doing. I mean, it hasn't changed again since then. I'm not sure that that's Julia. I'm not sure Julia would have done that without her editor. I mean, that's a great example of a collaboration.
Okay, I think we have time maybe for one more, and that's it.
I was just wondering if Julia made any attempt to franchise herself other than the cookbooks. Was there Julia Child products, pots, dishes, or anything as we are so inundated with today?
That was one of the main things that she committed to not doing very early on. As soon as the show started and she started to get famous, the invitations started pouring in. Promote this, use that, sell yourself here, make money there. She said no, and she said no for the rest of her life.
And I think she viewed James Beard as a cautionary tale on that, because they were close, but he sold himself out to anyone he could. Because in those days, there was no lucrative niche for a food person to live in, so any offer that came his way, he took. And I think she saw that and found it terribly sad because she liked him. And so she said, never.
Julia Vegas?
Well, there is Julia's Kitchen in Copia, which is that food and wine institute in Napa Valley, and it has her name. It's probably the only thing, commercial enterprise, that has her name on it, but it's purportedly for a noble cause. So.
We have time for one more, one lucky questioner. This.
Hi. I think a lot of the paradoxes and contradictions that I've been hearing from the panel have their root in the circumstance that Julia Child was never a chef. Never, never, never a chef. And the title of her show from the beginning was The French Chef.
You're right, and that could be another series of 10 books on that very issue. But she liked that title, and she wanted that title for the show because it was short, sharp, and professional. Some of the other suggestions were fun with cooking, and she shot those down. She wanted something with dignity and that gave some stature to the thing. So you're right, she was a home cook first, last, and always, and she taught home cooking. But I always think she had the mind of a chef. In another time and place and generation, she would have worked in a restaurant. She loved that. Those just rising to that height, she admired it tremendously. She thought chefs walked on water. She thought they were just the most wonderful, learned people. She had studied with great ones, and so she had... She had kind of the mind and aspiration of a chef, but it was all focused on reaching people in their own kitchens.
All right. Well, thank you to our panelists.
Thank you.
And there will be book signing back that way.